From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made when a 28-year-old woman went to talk to her oncologist. As the New York Times reports, Deborah Lindley Lopez was 28 when she was diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer. Almost immediately, she began chemotherapy, which forced her body into a state of medically induced menopause. But that wasn't why Deborah was seeing her doctor that day. Instead, she wanted to inquire about problems that she was having as a result of her treatment. The Times reports the following, quote, "She developed vaginal dryness so severe that her skin began to deteriorate and was covered in small, paper-cut-like tears. Urinating was uncomfortable. Sex was agonizing. But when Ms. Lindley Lopez, then at 31 years old, told her oncologist about her pain and how her libido had evaporated almost overnight, she said he responded dismissively, the doctor telling her that if he had a penny for every time he heard these complaints, he'd be a rich man sitting on a beach somewhere. He suggested she should just confide in the nurse about those symptoms," end quote. Deborah told The Times that she cried, adding, quote, "It was awful. It made me feel like, how could I even be thinking about anything else other than cancer? The fact that I would even ask about sex felt shameful," end quote. There is new research on this issue, and it is distressing. A study published a year ago finds that roughly 2/3 of women with cancer experienced sexual dysfunction, like orgasm problems and pain, and nearly 45% of young female cancer survivors remained uninterested in sex more than a year post-diagnosis. But research also indicates that many doctors don't even bring up sexual dysfunction or related issues during consultations. Many patients are left to find this out on their own, and they're mostly women. In the worst-case scenarios, like Deborah's, they're mocked for even asking. Yet men, when they go through treatment, are often asked about this, at least a lot more than women, according to surveys. And why? Sex is part of health. It's part of life. Why does this part of treatment remain in the dark ages? Sex therapists, sexual educators, and many others say it's time for that to change. And we're going to talk about that this hour. Let me welcome our guest now. Pebble Kranz is here. Dr. Kranz is medical director for the Rochester Center for Sexual Wellness, clinical assistant professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Rochester. Dr. Kranz, welcome back to the program. Thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Also, welcome to Dr. Sagina Giver-Geese, who is executive medical director of gynecologic oncology at Rochester Regional Health. Doctor, thank you for making time for the program.
Thanks for having me.
Jocelyn Bushard is here. Jocelyn is a nurse practitioner at the Wilmot Cancer Institute's Judy DiMarzo Cancer Survivorship Program and the Survive and Thrive Program. Thank you for being here, Jocelyn.
Thank you for having us.
And Tanya Anselm Cook is here, a patient telling her story. Thank you for being here as well.
Thank you.
So let me start with Dr. Kranz. And one of the themes, I feel like every time I talk to you, it's about some kind of aspect of taboo about sex in this society that you say, why can't we talk about this? I've got listeners who say, well, I'm sure your third rails are. Here's what you can't talk about. And I said, no, we talk about sex on the show. It's part of life. Mm-hmm. And yet I can tell you, even in my own experience, women I know who've gone through cancer, multiple, who this never came up with a doctor. They were left to find out on their own. Why is that happening?
Well, it is really profoundly unaddressed. While up to 90, even in some studies up to 100% of people who have been through a cancer experience have sexual concerns, and this is across many diagnoses, many kinds of cancer, only about 30% say that they have had any discussion with a medical provider about their sexual concerns. So a part of it, I think, is about that taboo. A part of it is that medical training. So first, we live in a culture in which general sexual education beyond reproduction, beyond infectious disease status is unaddressed. So there's a general societal taboo around sexual function and pleasure. And medical providers are existing from this culture, in this culture. And then medical training really hasn't included information about sexual anatomy and physiology, sexual function and dysfunction in a robust way until just recently. Well, actually, it's generally not including it. There are increasing efforts to get more information about sexual pleasure and satisfaction into medical education. And there's this new field of sexual medicine that looks at these specific issues. And so information dissemination to the medical world at large is slow. And there is still this taboo. I think medical providers often think, well, is pleasure my business? Is pleasure my job? And I, of course, would say yes, because pleasure is as much a part of the human experience as any other aspect of our physiology, any other aspect of our overall wellness. But there's still this taboo that gets in the way, and the lack of information often.
Can you also talk to us a little bit about why, from what we read reported, for example, in the New York Times, that men are more likely to be counseled about this than women are?
So this is an interesting thing. I
wonder if that surprises you.
No, it doesn't surprise me.
Okay.
So culturally, we have this idea, this script that men are sexual beings. Culturally, we have a script that women are not so much sexual beings. So that's one aspect. Another aspect is that while we talk with a lot of male cancer survivors about sexual function, that is primarily among people who are going through prostate, testicular, and penile cancers. Mm-hmm. And generally, the discussion of cancer's impact on sexual function when it comes to head and neck cancer, when it comes to blood cancers, when it comes to lung cancer, colorectal cancer, we're still doing a pretty bad job at talking to people. And even among prostate cancer survivors, the majority feel that they haven't had enough information, they haven't had enough valuable, useful information anyway. So we're not doing so great across the board, mm-hmm. but we do a little bit better when it comes to sexual cancers that affect the sexual organs of men.
Of men. And I don't want to sort of tie too much together, but I am thinking of a conversation we had a number of years back on this program where we were talking about how some of the language that we use and the framing that we have about sex in society kind of imbues ideas growing up. And I will not lie, I remember sitting at a lunch table in high school and hearing guys talk about, you know, who's, quote, getting some versus who, you know, which girls are giving it up, as if it's like it's the man or the boy's idea to try to get it. And, you know, the girls or women, they don't really want to do it, but you might have to convince them to give it up. And it's this idea of, well, the males are the ones who seek actual pleasure. And the females are just, they can decide whether or not they want to give it up, but they don't really want that. And does that then kind of bleed into this idea of, well, we don't talk to female patients who are going through cancer about this because that's not a priority.
Right. So it's an assumption that it's not
of importance.
Is this
connected in any way? I mean, like, does this connect?
Oh, sure. We're all in the cultural soup that is giving us all of these messages. And living with all of these scripts about what it means to be female, what it means to be male, what is proper, what is improper, that is still a very active confusion for a lot of people.
So let me ask our other guests. Dr. Giever Geese is Executive Medical Director of Gynecologic Oncology at Rochester Regional Health. Have you seen changes in this subject over the years? Is there still room for growth? And I'm also curious if the New York Times article, if you had a chance to read it, if those stories surprised you at all.
They didn't surprise me at all. And, you know, you're absolutely right. I think this is something that needs, you know, deserves to be talked about, because I think we have a lot of females who don't talk to their doctor, and we have a lot of physicians who don't know how to talk to their patients about mm-hmm. this. You know, if you think about from a cultural standpoint, our culture really talks, you know, has a lot of shame around sex. And in terms of women, you know, there's a cultural belief that sex is for procreation. And a virtuous woman ought not enjoy sex. And if she does, ought not admit it, right? And so our culture tells her to speak to her doctor about sexual function is not okay. And so she says nothing until someone like me asks. But I think physicians also face the consequences of our Western heritage and have those same cultural pressures like you talked about, Pebble. So they can be embarrassed to really talk about it. But our Western approach to medicine also generates most of the barriers on the physician side. We tend to specialize, compartmentalize, mm-hmm. and it's easy to persuade ourselves that a patient's emotional, psychological, and spiritual health is not our responsibility. So I think health providers are also working in a context that there's so little time and so many needs. It's hard to squeeze in a question about sexual dysfunction in the confines of a 15-minute appointment. So the truth is, even if we had the time, dealing with sexual dysfunction is not part of our training. It wasn't part of mine. And so we're really out of our comfort zone. And I think all too often a physician doesn't initiate the conversation about sex because we're not sure what to say after that.
Yeah, I want to say I really appreciate the point about time and prioritization of care. Anybody listening right now, you don't have to have gone through cancer to relate to the frustration of saying, well, how much time do I actually get to ask questions? Whenever my mother sees the doctor, she calls me and I'm like, how much? Why didn't you just put me on speaker? Because she gets very nervous because she doesn't feel like she has enough time. So that I get. But the coda to your point, Dr. Giverghese, is that even if there were time, there's still not a lot of training or discussion. So if and when you bring it up with patients, how do you do that? And are you trying to see more of your colleagues initiate these kind of conversations?
So you had asked the question about, is this becoming more of a topic?
Yeah.
And I think as more women are entering into the field of GYN oncology, we're feeling more comfortable about talking it, mm-hmm. About it. It's also in our professional meetings, we'll often address sexual dysfunction. Research is finally beginning to bear fruit, but mm-hmm. we've just started. So, you know, really it's not enough yet. We have a lot more to do. And in terms of what do I ask patients, so I actually have a review of systems sheet that has sexual dysfunction questions. And so if a patient, you know, circles decreased libido or vaginal dryness or pain with intercourse, that's an opening for me. Some patients will just say none, and it's not a concern for them. But if they circle that, then that's an introduction. That's something that I can then ask about. And then we go from there. Because some patients are like, you know, I'm not supposed to talk about this. I don't feel comfortable. And then I back off. But if they do, and if it is important to them, I want to make sure, and particularly to all your listeners, that cancer doesn't mean the end of sex, right? And that women can enjoy sex even with a cancer diagnosis or after cancer treatment.
Let me ask Jocelyn Bushard about this, a nurse practitioner at the Wilmot Cancer Institute's Judy DiMarzo Cancer Survivorship Program and the Survive and Thrive Program. How do you see this issue, and have you seen changes?
Yeah, so, you know, more patients are definitely, the more we ask patients, the more we see the problem is there. Mm-hmm. We always say, you know, providers don't know always how to ask, and patients don't know how to bring it up. Mm-hmm. So it is a big deal. I think with, you know, various medications, patients are living longer, patients are surviving longer. And because of this, you know, we're talking about quality of life and sexuality as a part of that.
What do you think is a reasonable goal that patients should have for their providers, knowing that, as Dr. Giverghese said, you all have these constrictions on time, and everyone would want more resources and more staff and a chance to really sit and get to know every need of a patient. But what's a realistic goal here? What does that look like?
Yeah, so a lot of times, like in my own experience, when we're seeing patients, if there's a specific topic that we want to go into more detail with and we don't have the time, we'll actually schedule a second visit.
I imagine they appreciate that.
Yeah.
Do you think it's more patients who are uncomfortable talking about this or more providers?
I think it's a little bit of both, definitely.
Dr. Giebergeese is kind of smiling at that question. What do you think?
I think it's providers because we don't know what to do with it. It hasn't been part of our training. And so if the question is, I have pain, okay, you have pain. You know,
right.
I mean, meaning, you know, and I'm grateful because I've known Pebblecrantz for a while. And the first thing I'll do is ask some basic questions and say, you know, can I refer you to actual sexual medicine physician? And then they're very interested that there's this topic, there's this, you know, specialty of sexual medicine. So I think advocating for the patient, letting them know it's okay to talk about this, but also say, here are the people who can help you, and I'm going to support you in that, I think is really important.
Yeah. I think medical providers feel overwhelmed about time around things they don't feel prepared to help people with.
Sure.
So that is a component of feeling like, oh my gosh, I'm opening up this can of worms and I don't know how to help this person with it. And so is it worth a whole extra appointment or is it worth this time? And as medical providers know more, there's more feeling that it's addressable in the way that Dr. Giebergeese is saying. And so, there are resources. I also want to point out, too, that we have a growing population of resources here in this community. Jocelyn and her colleagues in the Survivorship Clinic have done additional training around sexual health specific to cancer survivorship. We have more certified sex therapists in this region than we have at any point in time over the last 20 years, and more people interested in getting this training. And we have other medical providers in the community who are also getting more resourceful in this area, specialized in this area. So it's an exciting time for pleasure in Rochester.
Well,
absolutely.
That's one way to say it. I do hope that, I mean, I'm sure everyone agrees that the one aspect of this that has to be sort of baseline unacceptable is the experience that the Times described for Deborah Lynn Lee Lopez. It was the patient that they profiled, who was literally laughed at by her doctor, who told her, oh, you know, you have pain, huh? Well, if I had a penny for every patient who told me that, I'd be retired sitting on a beach somewhere. Why don't you talk to a nurse about it? I cannot. That is beyond inappropriate, is it not?
Absolutely. I think that is compounding the shame of this. It's solidifying this idea that one's sexuality is simply a casualty of cancer. It doesn't need to be. It shouldn't be. It's a part of living the life that one has fought so hard for.
Yeah, and Dr. Giebergeese, I'm trying to be generous because perhaps that doctor just felt uncomfortable and was trying to sort of make it a light moment, but you don't
have to. No, that was plain mean. That was harsh. That was mean.
I can't believe that's very common. I mean, I know that the Times chose that story as a way of saying this is the extreme end of what patients, often women, have to go through. I hope it's not common.
I would hope not. I would hope not. But, I will tell you, Evan, that when patients undergo cancer surgery and the type of surgeries that I do, they often feel less than, right? Because I've cut away at their femininity and their womanhood when I remove their ovaries and their uterus. And, you know, this is all part of their cancer treatment. But they often will feel less than. They don't feel like a woman and they struggle with body image issues. Mm-hmm. And so when I read that article, I mean, that's cruel. That's actually cruel. I think for any patient who has any symptom or any issue, as a provider, we need to address that. We take it seriously. So joking about anything or saying something sarcastic is inappropriate.
Anything you want to add there, Jocelyn?
I just think it's very interesting because we wouldn't expect the same if we were asking males or in that case.
Yeah. You might expect that a male patient's concern about their erectile dysfunction would be addressed in a more compassionate way.
Respected way?
Yeah.
So maybe some low-key or even high-key misogyny there. But I want to get Tanya Anselm Cook is a patient, and I want to give you some space just to describe your own story and however you want to do that.
Well, thank you. So there's probably three things to touch on. One, my cancer was not unexpected. My mother died of ovarian cancer. My grandmother and my uncle both died of pancreatic liver cancer. So we have a lot of estrogen-based or hormonal-based cancers in our family. And I've been diligent about mammograms and transvag ultrasounds and so forth over the years. And even had the complete genetic workup to see if I had any of the genetic factors. All of those always came back negative. And I credit finding this cancer that I have, which is lobular carcinoma stage 4, to a dermatologist. I had warts on my foot. Went in to get the warts looked at and happened to say, hey, I have this lump on my neck. What do you think? And I also had some lumps on my left chest. Nothing is more than the size of a grain of rice or a small black bean. And they don't hurt, and they're not red, and they're not attached, and they've never itched, and they came up all of a sudden with no fanfare or anything else. And she took a biopsy of one that was in my armpit, and 2 weeks later came back as stage 4. I had already had a hysterectomy because of my mother's ovarian cancer, and because at one time markers had gone up, and basically I thought, you know, the girls and I have partied, they can go. I wasn't going to be in pain about this. But what it left me with was a hip-to-hip scar, and that was on top of the scar that I had for the C-section for when I had my daughter, our daughter. So now I have a scar that is that reshaped my belly, and the scar, having another scar on top of it, was uncomfortable and a lack of sensation from where the scar is on down in a very peculiar way. I could tell if something was touching me, but it almost felt like when your leg goes asleep, and you touch your skin and your body goes, whoa, let's not do that again. So I was already aware of some of the physical effects of having a surgery. The cancer I have is not going to have surgery. So all the things that I have with the treatment of this one are the things that are unseen. What hit me dramatically in the article was when she was talking about voiding it was not the initial shock of having cancer. It was the months afterwards when the effects of the things that take the estrogen away. So the cancer I have is kind of starve it and kill it. So it's a two-pronged approach, but it depletes my system of estrogen, which means dryness. And it would feel, when I would go to the bathroom, like I was wiping shards of glass. And my mouth is very dry because of the lack of estrogen. And my eyes are dry. And so there's a lot of little things that come into play that you begin to go, wow, I have to take care of myself in a whole different way. And that impacts how I see myself, because now I have to do eye drops and take care of my mouth in a different way. And I have things that are for vaginal moisture and things that are for lubrication. And as Pebble has described before to me, Dr. Kranz has, there's a difference between skin that has hair and skin that doesn't. And I'm thinking to myself as I'm learning all of this, I've got 30 years in as a nurse, and I didn't know these things. The other part of it, we have so much shame about our pelvis and about the organs that bring pleasure. There is so much shame, even to the point of having to have things so covered up, that when I would go to when I would go to the Wilmot Center, the oncology area, that the parts of me that were that nobody sees but that were hurting the most still needed to be covered up, still needed to, you know, very kindly ask permission to, can we talk about this? Can we see what's going on? But the overlying thing there just has hit me so much in the past few months. I'm 18 months into my diagnosis now, of how much shame there is that gets in the way of talking about your not just sexual health, but pleasure. Mm. You know, it is deeply disturbing when wiping yourself is not pleasurable, you know. And so it's been quite a journey.
How are you doing these days?
As far as the cancer diagnosis goes, my end goal beyond what statistics are is I'm expecting to live with it, not die from it, you know. So we'll see, but that's the goal. However, there is going to always be the things that I have to do to manage the medications that keep the cancer stable. And those are the things that are more important to me now, actually, than anything, because there's a key word that we've talked about here that I've heard before, which is pleasure. Pleasure is not the same as sex. Mm-hmm. But without pleasure, you cannot enjoy sex. And pleasure is everything from having a piece of chocolate to sleeping in cotton pajamas to sitting outside in the wee hours when you can't sleep and listening to the tree frogs. You know, that those are the things that build up my own ability to be able to know what brings me pleasure so that when intimacy can happen, I'm clear on what it is that is pleasurable, and that feeds the trust that goes with intimacy, and intimacy is what brings the pleasure for sex.
What do you think partners of cancer patients need to understand about all of this?
That's a question that I actually asked of several friends of mine before coming on the show. And quickly, what I thought was going to be just a small rabbit hole turned into a coal mine. That it's deep. That is a really deep question. And maybe others can chime in on this too. But that means you have to talk to your partner. And it means the partner has to be willing to talk to you. And you have to be willing to say that I own my own body, I own my own pleasure, and how does that affect you? And the other person has to be willing to see you not as their possession or as their, as they need to see you. And that's been the hardest part with cancer for me, is actually being seen, because I don't look like I have stage 4 cancer, you know? But that's one of the hardest things, but maybe chime in on that one.
Dr. Kranz, do you want to start?
Well, I think you bring up an excellent point, Tanya. First, partners need to be able to talk, and they need to be able to have discussions about their physical life together. They need to be able to have conversations about pleasure. One of the things that I talk with people all the time about is what feels good in this body now, right? It might be a whole different place of discovery than it has been for the time in which you've gotten to know your body before. But things feel good in this body now. One of the things that is, I think, hard both for individuals and in partnerships is that this earthquake of cancer comes along with a wish for the way things were, right? Mm-hmm. A wish for things to go back to the way it was. And what one fact is, is that pleasure is possible in all bodies. Pleasure is often possible between bodies in all kinds of different ways. And the other thing that is true is that change is inevitable. Change is something that has happened. And so there is this balance between finding a place of acceptance of the changes in our bodies that have occurred, and what can we do to explore pleasure in a new way for myself, in my own body? What does my pleasure mean to me? What is the pleasure between us as partners, among us as partners? What is possible now? It's sort of a new territory of discovery, potentially. But it requires some grieving often first about the way things were in the past. And we don't have, and this is a kind of grieving that is hard to do because it's something that in the therapy world we call disenfranchised grief. So there are all kinds of grievings that go along with a cancer experience that you can share with the people around you, you know, or that they can see. Right? Somebody has had a surgery that is visible, and people can share in that grieving. The grieving for the sexual life that was is not a kind of grieving that we get to do in community, right? It's not a kind of grieving that most people are sitting down and talking with their friends and their family about. I just miss my orgasms so much. They were a really important part of knowing who I am. And I don't know if I'll ever have an orgasm again. And that kind of grieving needs to happen before we can do all of the things we can do to help people, which there are lots of things we can do to help people.
We are going to talk about that before the hour's over, because I don't want to leave the impression with listeners that, like, well, cancer is like the death knell for any sexual pleasure. I mean, we're being direct about a tough subject that a lot of people have struggled to talk about. But we are going to, before the hour's up, we're going to get to that in a moment. I'm going to ask our other guests if they also want to weigh in on this. Dr. Giebergiess, anything you want to add here? And what, especially what partners might be important for partners to know.
Yeah, I think partners in general are trying to be supportive. And so they will try to say things that often are not helpful. Be positive, it's okay, everything. But the problem is, I do think it takes some time to mourn the way life was. I think that's an excellent point, Dr. Krantz, that we do take a moment to recognize that life as we knew it is no longer, but it doesn't mean that there's not going to be joy in the life ahead. That the struggle, that there may be pain there, but that we're going to work on this together to continue intimacy in a different way, you know, to find pleasure. And I think that's the key thing is for patients and for their partners, suddenly you have a calendar of events. There's lab draws, there's chemotherapy, there's surgery, there's all these appointments. And so there's this busyness and hectic life of trying to make these appointments and do things that we don't take time to do the pleasurable things of listening to the birds or the crickets at night or the cotton sheets or cotton pajamas, like those type of things, because it's so much life has changed and we don't even recognize what's happened. But I do think taking that moment to just say, it's okay to grieve. It's okay to be upset. You don't always have to be positive. It's not going to cause your cancer to grow, right? It's okay to go through those steps of grieving and then recognize, as long as you can keep moving, as long as you can put one foot in front of the other, it's okay. And so I often will encourage my patients and their partners to accept what's happened, but then recognize that, you know, we're going to journey together in this. There is going to be hope in this. Mm-hmm. And that's my hope in walking with my patients, is always to provide that dignity, that hope in what the next steps are.
Yeah.
Anything you want to add, Jocelyn?
Yeah, I think that's so important, because I feel like, you know, we rarely see couples have a conversation about how they're going to put their sex life together after something like this. So I think, you know, we need to be role models bringing it up, like you said, and take that journey with them.
Yeah. Dr. Krantz was a therapist years ago, and we got a break in just a second, and then we're going to talk about, productive approaches going forward that don't mean the end of everything. A therapist said years ago on this program that sometimes people get confused and they'll say, like, well, this couple's in trouble, you know, like they're not having a lot of sex. And the therapist's always like, well, is that the frequency they want? Because some couples might need it four times a week. Some couples might need it four times a year. But if there is sort of cohesion in what pleasure is needed and what they're looking for, and if they're aligned, and if there's mutual respect and good communication, then the frequency is not really a baseline of what matters most. It's about an agreement. This challenge of cancer may take what was aligned before and break that apart. And that takes some time to communicate and put back together a new approach. Is that fair?
Absolutely. Yeah. So there are discrepancies in any relationship. Sexual frequency, kinds of sex that people want, that's no different from the discrepancies that occur in relationship around, you know, how you load the dishwasher. Like, one loads the dishwasher like a, Swedish architect, and the other loads the dishwasher like a raccoon on meth. So
you have a camera in my house.
Mine too. And so, you know, so these discrepancies are present in most relationships, and but sometimes people are in sync and they get accustomed to being in sync, and it might not have been something that they've talked about, and then there's a experience like a cancer diagnosis and treatment that disrupts that. Sometimes there are relational issues sexually or relational issues generally prior to a cancer diagnosis. And then this earthquake of cancer and cancer treatment disrupts things further. And that can be painful for all around, and that will make it harder when those underlying issues haven't really been addressed before there's a stress like cancer or a chronic illness. The one thing that I forgot to say about partners, I love having a conversation because I think of so many things. So one of the things that happens in cancer is that a partnership can become this caretaking team, like this cancer fighting team, and feel very solid and supportive around addressing the caretaking needs. And what gets lost is this playful, intimate team, this relationship in which you experience pleasure and playfulness and vulnerability and fun with a person. And partners can help partners with cancer by making sure that playful, intimate, fun team doesn't get lost. Because it can be easy for the person with cancer to not have contact with that.
We have to take this only break, and we're going to come back and talk much more about what can be done as we talk about cancer, sexual health, and the conversations that don't happen often enough when patients need it. We'll be right back. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, in our first hour, we talk with Assemblymember Josh Jensen about New York's new budget and related issues like bail reform, housing, childcare, and more. In our second hour, we're joined by Richard and Leah Rothstein, co-authors of Just Action. In Richard Rothstein's first book, The Color of Law, he explained how the government created segregated societies in our country. And the new book, they're talking about how that segregation can be undone. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Just want to remind listeners, if you're tuning in late, why we're here. We're having a conversation that our guests are telling us doesn't happen often enough when patients go through cancer treatment. Often we are talking about women, but not always. In general, patients aren't counseled very well on the possible impact of cancer treatment on sexual health. And this is all kinds of cancers. Chemotherapy can do a lot to libido, can do a lot to sexual function and pleasure and desire. But obviously, different kinds of cancers may impact the body in different ways. And the lack of counseling about this surprises some patients when all of a sudden, you know, you may be on the quote unquote other side of cancer, and that all of a sudden though, now your sexual health is dramatically impacted and no one warned you this was coming. Men get counseled more than women on this, but still not enough. And our guests are taking us through what that means and maybe how to change that. Brittany writes to us to say, I wanted to share a great book called Is This Normal? By Dr. Jolene Brighton. Touches on a lot of what you're talking about, an amazing resource for all people, but specifically women, to answer a lot of the questions we are too nervous to talk about with our providers or even our network. Thank you so much for this conversation. That is from Brittany. And I know it can be a hard thing to talk about. It can be too hard for couples. It could be hard for doctors and nurses and patients and friends and families. But let's talk about maybe the upside or the positive side here. So I'm going to start with Dr. Giebergies, who is Executive Medical Director of Gynecologic Oncology at Rochester Regional Health. And when your patients are worried that things have changed, whether it's libido or the physical function or pain, how do you start walking them through what can be done or how that can be approached?
So I will tell you, I know some of the basic things to do in terms of vaginal estrogen or systemic estrogen, because a lot of the times, particularly the surgeries that I do, patients lose their estrogen, their hormones. And so they can often face discomfort from the lack of estrogen. So those simple things of prescribing oral or vaginal estrogen, that I can do. I can talk to them about, in terms of pain, I can often talk to them about sexual medicine physician and a referral. Talk to them about pelvic PT. That actually exists, and a lot of people don't realize that that's a resource, but there are actual physical therapists who specialize in the pelvis.
Can I jump in real
Absolutely.
Quick?
Absolutely.
Pelvic physical therapy is something I did not know existed, and it has been marvelous. Because there were some things connected to my pelvic wellness that I didn't realize had to do with my lower back pain. Mm-hmm. I just want to let anyone who's listening know that there's a whole wonderful world of help that has to do with pelvic PT. And there are more physical therapists who are specializing in that. It's just been really quiet for a long time.
Mm-hmm. Tanya, how are you doing in terms of when your treatment started versus today with just your own expectation for what you want and what is pleasurable to you and what has helped with it? So you talk about physical therapy, but how are you doing with the rest of it?
So the physical therapy has been integral to strengthening things. So lack of estrogen means that things get weak and that they get friable. And correcting that situation is joyful. There's just no other way to put it. It's just full of joy to not have low back pain, to not worry about, am I going to leak? To not worry about, am I going to hurt? It's been a ripple effect that went far beyond the whole question of, well, what about sex down there? Is that ever going to happen again? The other thing that I'm really focusing on is, what is pleasure? You know, pleasure and sex are not the same thing, but it's really hard to have one without the other. But it's possible to have one without the other. And so if I don't know what brings me comfort and joy and fun, if I don't recognize that in myself, how am I going to recognize it when someone is offering that to me?
Was there ever a point in your treatment where you thought you might be done with sex?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got to pelvic wellness through kind of an indirect conversation, but I was in the right place at the right time at the Wilmot Cancer Center, where both the physician and the nurse practitioner were very aware of sexual wellness. And they were able to bridge that conversation over my own discomfort with what was happening with my body and say, why don't you go see this person? Why don't you look into the whole pelvic wellness, you know, idea? So I was in the right place at the right time with the right people. It doesn't always go that way. I have a friend, so prior to coming, I asked several friends, you know, like I'd said, you know, what would you want to hear? And one of my friends who had a radical double mastectomy, she was left with what her surgeon called a little titlet in case later she wanted to have just a little extra tag of skin in case she wanted to have surgery to mm-hmm. have breast implants later. And her experience of going through cancer, she actually was with me with my first post-diagnosis meeting. And it was life-changing for her to know that you could have people who were that kind talking about things that were that personal and who, even though it didn't happen right away, this has been a progress over time, who are willing at least to have the conversations that come up over time.
Are you a writer?
No.
This can be, I mean, there's a book here. You are a phenomenal communicator, and I'm just grateful that you've been here talking, I think, modeling what it is like to talk openly about mm-hmm. what are sometimes viewed as hard or taboo subjects. They need not be, but often they are. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're hearing from Tanya, I hope, is giving people hope. You know, you certainly seem to be in a good place today, and that's a very hopeful thing.
Chocolate. I decided to go Pavlovian on myself. And every time I have to take one of my medicines, I eat a piece of chocolate. And that way, anytime
Pavlov,
I eat...
It's like Pavlov's ring the bell and I'll salivate. So
there you go.
There you go. I like it. Jocelyn, what would you say to a patient who says, you know, I thought I was going to have to part with sex, but I don't want to. How do I go forward here?
Yeah, I mean, I guess before we start this conversation with anyone, we always ask permission, make sure they're comfortable talking about it. Yep. I think that's huge. And to normalize it, to make sure that patients realize that treatments and their cancer may change things, and just asking simple questions like, what specifically has changed? What do they need help with? Just asking the very specifics. It's a lot of questions to really get down to the specific of what they need help with.
And Dr. Giverghese, before the hour's up, I think it's also important to ask that if patients don't feel like they're getting counseling that is either respectful or even just open and knowledgeable with their providers, what would you advise them to do?
Seek a different provider.
Yeah, okay. Right? Really, yeah?
Yeah. I think you need to have a physician who you trust. You need to have someone that you can talk about anything, and particularly the things that I do. I'm in an intimate area, and I want my patients to be able to share their concerns, their worries, their frustrations. You know, a lot of times when I walk with patients, they will tell me not only what's going on with their family. I mean, it has nothing to do necessarily with their cancer treatment, but I often will know about how their families are doing, how various stressors are happening, you know, what their daughter said and that the daughter needs counseling. I mean, I think it's really important that there is an intimacy and a trust between a provider and a patient. And if the provider doesn't recognize that, that holiness in that trust, I think you have other options.
Let me close with a note from Holly Anderson at the Breast Cancer Coalition. It says, the coalition has aggressively and assertively addressed sexual and intimacy challenges for years and have encouraged providers to take the time to have meaningful conversations about sex and intimacy with their patients after treatment for breast or gynecologic cancer and counsel patients to not wait to be asked. It's actually a frequent topic here at the Coalition. This kind of community building, a place to have safe conversations and learn from each other, is essential. We sit with women, lean in, and ask them if they have concerns about sex and intimacy, ask them if the topic has been covered in follow-up visits, ask them about their level of comfort bringing it up with their provider. This topic should be addressed by providers carefully and with compassion. This means turning away from the laptop, leaning in, and allowing time for a thoughtful response, a response that is often accompanied by tears and expressions of grief. This takes deep compassion and time, something our healthcare system has precious little of sometimes. Hello, by the way, to Drs. Kranz and Giver-Gies, both frequent presenters here at the Coalition. Thank you for this conversation. That's Holly Anderson at the Breast Cancer Coalition. 20 seconds. What do you want to leave us with?
There is so much that is possible for pleasure in the wake of a cancer experience. Cancer Wellness Connections 2 is sponsoring a conversation group around gynecologic and breast cancer and sexuality. New session coming up this fall in September. Thank you so much, Evan, for being willing to have these hard conversations.
They don't have to always be as hard as they are. I know they can be hard, but I take the point. And we'll link, by the way, to what Dr. Kranz is talking about to get more people connected. Thank you for being here, Dr. Kranz.
Thank you.
Appreciate you very much. Thank you, Dr. Giver-Gies. Thank you for the expertise this hour. Thanks to Jocelyn Buschert from the DiMarzo Cancer Survivorship Program, the Survive and Thrive Program. Thanks for being
here.
And Tanya Anselm Cook, continued good health and thriving to you. Thank you for being here. From the whole team at Connections, thanks for listening. We're back with you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.